Today I want to talk about land in both of my lectures. This one's called Aboriginal European Meanings of Land. The second one is called Possessing Australia. So I want to talk about the issue of land. I want to start by saying that the issue of land is an extremely complex and difficult thing for us to understand. Aboriginal ideas, of course, are diverse and multiple across Australia. There are different peoples owning different parcels of land, each with perhaps different ideas. But there are some overarching ideas as well. Now, this is still a problem for us because I think we shouldn't be arrogant enough to think that we can understand the Aboriginal relationship to the land in one lecture and a tutorial. But I think we will make a start, and if we don't approach it arrogantly, like, well, this is going to be easy to understand, then I think we'll go even further still. So I want to stress that I'm going to talk in the lecture of a couple of case studies briefly about Aboriginal relationship to the land. We're going to have a further discussion in the tutorial, but I hope that that's just a beginning for you rather than an end of the matter of trying to understand the Aboriginal relationship to the land. Because as I think I'll be saying in these two lectures, the land is a key issue and still is, as you probably are aware, a key issue between settler and Indigenous peoples. And it has always been thus. So let's look at some case studies. This is an image drawn by a man called Panduck. He was a Dimmin man of the 1930s up in the Northern Territory. And he had some exchanges with one of Australia's foremost anthropologists, William Stanner. Now, Stanner was working on issues of cultural ideas, traditional culture, and that, of course, inevitably involved him in the ideas of land. And at one stage, he asked Panduck, would he draw his view of the cosmos? Now, we've all done this in our exercise books as primary school children, tried to place ourselves in the world, and it does give some revealing ideas about our key driving ideas and our intellectual ideas, whether they be religious or scientific or whatever. So Panduck drew this very vibrant image for the anthropologist Stanner, and you can see here that it is a work of the high imagination with a lot of layers to it. And it's got roughly about five layers. And in one of those layers, there are various suns, and that's the top layer. But there's more than one sun, and that's very interesting. And Panduck believed that these suns revolved into the sky and then went down under the earth and came back out again, that there were multiple suns and the suns had different genders. So for a start, we see some very interesting differences with our own view of the world, because we've tended to lose the notion of the world as being, the natural world as being a gendered place. Our language has lost the notion of being gendered, although the Romance languages still give gender to their language. So it was an interesting thing then. Of course, he's got the second layer of the Milky Way, the stars. The third is the planets. And then down the bottom you see country, and below that you can see those other suns under the earth. And with his view of the country, you can see that he's divided up the country into discrete bands, shown by those ridges with trees on the top. So that the notion is that there are multiple countries and that there are boundaries to them. And so we can start to get an idea of how Aboriginal people conceive the land. It was an intimate one, it was a gendered view of the world, and there was a belief in ownership. Our second case study is provided by encounters that a British garrison had with a man called Macare. This was at the site of Albany today, down in Western Australia. And this happened in the 1820s. And this garrison was placed there, a small garrison of less than a dozen men, to put a British presence on the southwest coast of Australia to forestall any French interest, because Australia was a place of European rivalries, like many other colonial places were. So the British garrison was put there, and because it was a very small garrison, they had very deep and intimate exchanges with local Aboriginal people. And one of the men there, Captain Barker, wrote down all that he experienced in those few years at Albany, and particularly he wrote down his discussions and conversations he had with this man, Macare. Now, this was a painting done by the French, who had visited there a little bit earlier than the English, and that's why the English were there, because they knew the French were sniffing around the south coast. So we know what Macare looks like, and through Barker's journals, we actually know a great deal about Macare and his worldview. But this is the thing that many observers had to do over generations, was to try and piece together the Aboriginal world from fragments. That's what Stanner did by asking Pandut to draw his world. But of course, Stanner only got a very imperfect explanation of what that world was. And we only have come down from Stanner's notes. We only know so much about what Pandut thought about the world. And the same with Macare. He gave certain information to Barker, and that's been pieced together by Ferguson, who's an anthropologist, who in the 1980s pieced together what we can know of Macare's world. Now, one of the interesting things is we can actually get a sense of Macare's view of land and land ownership, and that's just sort of caught up with these two words, Macare's estate and Macare's range. And this was actually a typology developed by Bill Stanner, William Stanner, when he tried to describe the Aboriginal world of land owning. And for him, these were key words. Now, by estate, Stanner meant the land that it was actually owned by the Aboriginal person that he was discussing. So the Macare's estate would be this small strip of land. This is current-day King George Sound. This is Albany. And perhaps 5 or 10 kilometres in from the coast in the Prince Charlotte Bay is this area here, denoted inside the red line, which was Macare and his older brother's landowning. That meant that they had possession of that land above all others. They had the rights and custodianship over that land, and anyone that came onto that land had to ask permission to be there through certain rituals and ceremonies, and also that they had to ask permission to do anything that might change that land, like burn the land. And so when the British arrived, actually Nankina, Macare's older brother and therefore the prime elder of the landowning group, was very upset that the British didn't come to see him and pay homage to him and ask permission to be there. And it took quite a while before he got his nose out of joint. But Macare, being the younger brother, had less of that reserve, and he spoke to them more readily. So we know that this was the area that they owned, they had control of, custodianship over. But there is this other area, and this second map here shows this area here, down just on this little bit here. And there is this much wider area, which we might call Macare's range. And we know that Macare moved over this wider area of land, partly because he did so in journeys with the British. But we also know that land had boundaries, because at certain points, and they're marked on 1, 2 and whatever on the map here, Macare got here and then refused to go any further because he said, this place is alien to me. He didn't want to go any further. So we know that he had a sense of a range, but beyond that point, he did not go. Now, that range was not his area that he owned, but the area he used. It was his livelihood, if you like, his living area. And Macare got rights to that through kinship relations and interactions with Aboriginal groups. As a young man, probably a youth of maybe 16 or 17 or 18, he would have left his home country of King George's Sound and he would have lived with families in this wider area, perhaps for 3 or 6 months or 9 months. And by living in that area, he built up relations with those families. He built up relations with other young men. He built up knowledge of that country and how to use it, its seasons, its fruits, its vegetables, its game. And he also built up very important connections for him in the sense that he would find a bride from that area. So that you can see that period in his late youth, by the time he'd become an initiated person but was still inexperienced, was an extremely important time for him because he got rights to that land. So we can see, therefore, that Aboriginal land holding is multiple and flexible, and that there are key rights held by the custodians and then usage rights held in a wider area upon permission, upon building up the right relations. And just to show you that this is a fairly universal model that is across the country, we can go to the area of our own place, that is the Melbourne region. And the picture here shown is the man Billy Baleri, one of the signatories of the Batman Treaty I'll be speaking a little bit about later. And Billy Baleri was an elder called a Nurungaeta in Aboriginal languages of the Melbourne region. He was a landowner of the region around from Melbourne up to Mount Macedon. He was a very important owner of a key industrial site, which was the Axe Head Quarry at Mount William, up towards Mount Macedon, where a lot of the axe head blanks were forged out of the basalt rock and then traded to great lengths. Sometimes they were traded as far as South Australia, up into southern New South Wales, because they were such a valuable trade item and seen to be the best axe heads in Victoria. That's why they were traded so far. So Billy Baleri had control of that site, he and his family. And we know a lot about this because he also forged a very close relationship with William Thomas, who was the Aboriginal protector in the Melbourne region. And they knew each other for about 7 years before Billy Baleri died of influenza, probably in 1846. And they used to spend a great deal of time together, talk around the fire, they would sleep under the stars together, they would travel together, and they had many, many conversations. So William Thomas wrote down in his journal, so whatever we think of protectors, missionaries, etc., they did a lot of writing, and we know a lot about Aboriginal people. And Aboriginal people know a lot about their forebears through these series of writings. So someone called Diane Barwick, who was a Canadian anthropologist who came to live in Melbourne and got fascinated with all the records of the Port Phillip Protectorate around the Melbourne region, read all the journals and diaries, William Thomas and others, and she started to put together a map of the Melbourne region, an Aboriginal map, that is. And this is what she constructed in an article published in the late 1980s. And you can see here again, it's a little bit hard to see on this map, but it shows that there are, in this central region, about 5 main cultural linguistic groups, one of them being the Bunurong and the Boonwurrung, the Woiwurrung, the Wathaurong over towards Geelong, and the Donjurong up here, Jajarong. Now these people formed a large area that had interactions with each other through kinship and particularly through marriage, because within each of these what we might call tribal boundaries, the word tribe went out of favour for a while, I think it's coming back in again, but these were cultural language groups. Within these there, you can see a lot of other little names, Bullock Willem, Warren Jerry Bullock, That means Bullock means people, Wurundjeri people. Bullock Willem, Willem means place, so the place of the Bullock people. These are all clans. These are all clans here. That is local landowning groups, just like we saw in Albany. So these are local landowners with rights over this land, but they are part of a larger cultural group, and these cultural groups are interconnected with the other groups that I showed you in this central region, and these call themselves the Kulin people, or a Kulin nation. And the thing was that because of genetic know-how, in a sense, intuitive genetic knowledge, people had to marry outside your clan. Because every clan was either one of two totems, either eagle, hawk or crow, Bunjil or Wah. You've probably seen the huge statue of Bunjil down near the Colonial Stadium, down by the river, a large white eagle. So Bunjil was the eagle, Wah was the crow. So every person, like in this room, we would be Bunjil or Wah people. That's our totem. It was called moieties. Everyone was divided. Now, a Bunjil person had to marry a Wah. You had to marry out. So if all your clan down here are all Bunjil people, you had to intermarry with someone else from another clan. And usually they went not just for a local one, but they went for another clan in the Kulin group. And that was good genetic sense because it got genetic diversity, but it also meant that all those people were linked because when you married someone, you had rights to the lands of that person's family. So women would usually come and live with the man's clan, but the man had rights back into the woman's lands. Now this is terrific environmental sense and land use sense because it means you've got access to a great diversity of resources which come together at particular seasons. So it's just very, very good sense. And this was all carefully worked out over thousands of years. But Europeans have taken a long time to understand it because it is very complex and sophisticated, and there's no Aboriginal land title office that you can go down and check it all out. There's no manuals of land holdings and usage and land law. So the Europeans, you know, let's give them a break. They made a lot of mistakes, but a lot of this was not very visible to them, and it took them a long time. And often anthropologists sitting down going through the old journals and records have taken a long time to piece it out. So this is the common threads then, to sum it up. This is a very sophisticated system, and you can see that there are individual ideas of land ownership or family land owning, but also there are shared ideas. So that Billy Baleri owned with his family the Axe Head Quarry, but he was also, as a member of a clan, the owner of a small parcel of land in a particular part of a wider tribal territory. So that it's layered. So multiple layers and, of course, multiple identities because, you know, the people in the clan have their own name for themselves. Wurundjeri Willem. So they've got their own names, but they've also one of the Wurrung people, one of the Kulin nation. So multiple identities as we do. But all those identities are connected to land. And of course they have rituals of possession and access. In this region here, there was a ritual called the Tandarum ceremony. If people came to visit, to use land, they had to make the right approaches, usually one of great deference. People in Aboriginal society didn't come up and say, "How you going? I'm from over the mountain there." They would sit away from the group. They would wait to be invited in. And then there would be a discussion, probably what would you want here, et cetera, et cetera. They would be known. If they were not known, there would be fighting. But they would establish how they all fitted together. And then there would be a ceremony in the Tanderrum, it was a burning of bushes to give someone like the keys of the city, the freedom of the bush. So that there were rituals of access, and therefore all that was a conscious acknowledgement that there were boundaries to people's landholding. But these boundaries are flexible because, you know, you could have access across boundaries for particular reasons, although that only stretched so far. Beyond that, these people were enemies. So there's a notion of friends and strangers. And friends were related through marriage, through kinship, etc. But enemies were to be, well, distrusted. They would bring possible sorcery, and therefore probably they were to be killed. And of course, all this is underpinned by, I think, religious meanings. And we need to talk a bit more about this in our tutorials. But it was something that just the drawing of maps denotes perhaps ownership, land holding, but it doesn't tell us about all the deeper meanings that land might have for people. And they might be summed up in the word dreaming. And again, it's Bill Stanner, who really was a remarkable anthropologist. There are not many others of his stature, maybe A.P. Elkin, also a very important anthropologist in Australia, and Catherine and her husband Berndt. The Berndts were important, but Stanner was important, and he wrote this seminal essay in the 1950s called The Dreaming, in which he tried to sum up for Europeans what Aboriginal people understood by their, religious view of the world. And he said, you know, the dreaming was a charter, a narrative of the world and how it had come to be. And for Aboriginal people, he said, it sort of was underpinned by a sense of oneness. It was a very holistic view. Everything was interconnected with everything else. And in fact, he said, their whole concept of time was different from our concept, which is very linear for most of us. And we see our lives as a linear projection. We see history as a linear projection. But Aboriginal people don't see time in that same sense. And they have a notion of every when. And I think, you know, we'll talk more about this in tutorials. But for him, the dreaming in European terms was the creation story of the local owners, the clan owners of the land, how their land came to be. And often it was a story that was interconnected with other people's stories. So, you know, the rainbow snake story might be shared by people throughout a whole region, but they would have local variations to be their story, and only they could tell that story. It's also, in many ways, a moral code of how to behave, and if you've ever read any Aboriginal Dreamtime stories, called by Europeans legends, but not by Aboriginal people, they might call them truths, not legends, then you can see that it's often bound up with the notion of a moral code. There was a painting by Clifford Possum Japaljari sold the other day for $2.3 million or $2.1 million, which was the highest amount paid for an Aboriginal painting. And of course, if it was allowed to go overseas under and hadn't been prevented from doing so by heritage legislation, it might have gone to $3 or $4 million overseas. Now, it was interesting that that was the fire dreaming from the Alice Springs area, and it was a story of the blue-tongued lizard who created fire to burn his own sons because they had been greedy. And that's how Aboriginal stories, Aboriginal truths about the past, are often moral lessons for how to behave. So it's a code of conduct. It's a metaphysics of how the world works. And for them, it's a key to reality. As I said, it's not legend, but truth. It's a key to understanding how everything fits together. And you can see this painting, which we will talk about again, because it was involved in the first land rights case in Australia. But that was drawn by Narajan Memu, a Mungalili man up at Yirrkala in Arnhem Land, drawn in the 1970s, and it tells the story of the Guark bird. The Guark bird, or the cuckoo, they're a bit hard to see. They're these two black figures here, and surrounding them are some possums and emu. And this is a central story for Narajan's people because it tells the way in which the land was shaped. And the interesting thing about this story is it was drawn and told by Memu, and yet he hadn't been on his land for 30 years because of being moved off, living on mission stations, etc. He hadn't been back to this bit of country, but he knew it and was able to draw it easily because of the knowledge which was relayed down to him. So these paintings are a whole series of things. There's certainly the story of how things occurred, the creation story. They're religious, if you like, in our terms, a Bible, a setting down of how things came to be and what it means. They're a primer in that they're a story for the young people of how the land was shaped and how ownership is attached. And so it's like a map or a deed in our terms. Of course, it tells the story. Each of those waves on the thing have a significance. They are attached to pieces of land. And there's a very interesting video up in the library where you can see Narajan talking about this painting and talking to a young person about a painting he's doing and saying, you know, this bit here, that's that sandhill. And you can see that there's a direct relationship between this drawing and the landscape. So they are very much maps. So now let's just talk about the people of Sydney, because we're going to be looking at first contacts in early Sydney. And we just need to get to know a little bit about the people and their land ownership. This is the area of Sydney, that's Port Jackson, as it's called in European terms. And the people of that area, there are three language groups totaling 3,000 or 4,000 people, the Ku'ringai, Daru and the Darawal. And the Eastern Daru were the Eora, and they were the people that came in first contact with the Europeans in 1788. And it's interesting that the word Eora means yes and country. So it's an affirmation of ownership. Yes, this is our country. That's how the word Eora evolved. And so this area had about six bands of Eora, and there was a whole range of ecologies in this area. And from an early sketch, we have William Lycett's drawing, which shows how much these people were fishers of the ocean. Which is very interesting, because over in Macare's part of the world, in King George's Sound, he never entered the water. He wasn't interested in eating fish, etc. But these people of Sydney were very much fishers. You can see that in these drawings. This was done by King, an early officer, and it was then later redrawn by William Blake, the great poet and artist of the late 18th century. So you can see these people had the implements of fishing, the barbed spears, the fish hooks and the twine fish ropes. And they used to also fish from those very small precarious canoes, and they often had a little fire built on a clay base in that canoe, and they would cook, eat, consume all at once and before going back to land. I suppose it was a good way of getting the best part of the fish before you took others back to share. But they were also people with a diverse range of foods, and they would go into the woodlands at certain times, and this is an early image of them around the Sydney region. And there it was the women who would come into the fore. The women certainly did fishing as well. They would dive down and get mussels and other things even in the cold part of winter. But they certainly were the gatherers of the society, and they would get a lot of vegetable things, tubers, orchids, which were in abundance. Little orchids this big, when gathered in the dozens, would create a salad-like foodstuff. But the macrosamia, which are the cycad palms, they were used extensively by Aboriginal people. That they're poisonous, and they had to be leached in water for several days to get the poison out. The men, of course, were the ones that chased the protein, kangaroo, possum, etc., which was a more less reliable source of food, but highly valued. So we know from some of the drawings of the early period in Sydney, and this was a man called Coeur Barragal. He was drawn by the French artists when they visited in 1788, because the French came only a few weeks after the British. We were about a fortnight away from speaking French in this room. So his image was drawn, and I actually have that image on my wall, and I find it a very, very engaging one. Even his name, the way it's intonated out by the artist who wrote it down, Coeur Barragal. Aboriginal speech was a soft intonation, very musical. That was one of the things that the Europeans noted. So by the way the name is stretched out with the hyphens, you can get a sense of how it was pronounced. And you can see from this man how his identity might have been formed by his just by this picture. Does anyone want to remark on anything that you can see as significant to talk about? Yep. Yes, he has. You mightn't be able to see them up the back, but he's got some cicatrisation. It was called long scars and a series of scars here. And these would have been denoting probably initiation and stages of manhood. It would have been quite painful to get those. Your tissue is cut by a sharp edge, maybe a bit of shellfish or a sharp flake from a stone. It's cut and ash is rubbed into it, and it's not allowed to heal flatly. It's filled with fat and ash, so it heals in a raised way to create that what was seen as beautiful body ornamentation. But what about also his headdress? You know, there was a sense that we can begin to know something about these people just by looking at pictures of them. This would have been cord made laboriously by either spinning animal fur together or vegetable matter, spinning it on the thigh or in the hands, making long cord, and then dyeing it with ochres or white clays, and then adorning the head. And Aboriginal people used to do a lot of that, and the Europeans often remarked on it. So what else can we know, though, from this thing? Do we know something about perhaps Pandak's religious ideas? That's very difficult to do. We might see that his implements might have had marks on them showing perhaps ideas of something mystical or religious to make those weapons work better. Sometimes early Aboriginal people were seen doing ceremony, and they might have been either burials or, in this case, it's an initiation. You can see all the young initiate boys lined up on the left-hand side. The elders are doing ritual before them and probably about to take them aside and knock one of their front teeth out, just like as a sign of you becoming a man, a sign for everyone to see, and, of course, a bit painful on the way, so something you have to endure. But there's many, many things, of course, we cannot know about early Aboriginal society. And one of the things, of course, was, as I was saying, we can't know about the land, use of the land. Now, what we're doing is we're entering a long colonial story. By looking at 1788 and the first contacts, and we'll be doing that next week, we are entering a European story of colonisation, which began when the Portuguese started to trek and voyage down the east coast, the west coast of Africa, and penetrate to the Indies. Magellan circumnavigated the world 1519 to 1522. The Spanish finally penetrated into the Pacific, and Quiros got to Vanuatu as it is today, 1606. And then the Dutch started to touch landfalls in Australia. Jansz in Doifken, the Little Dove, in 1605 up near Arnhem Land and the Gulf Country. And then Dirk Hartog touched at Shark Bay in the west in 1616. So then Tasman, of course, makes his landfalls at Tasmania. So that we should remember we are part of a long colonial story, and the Europeans came to Australia with certain understandings that were informed by that colonial story of which they were part. And here we see a Dutch map of the world that time, with just the beginnings of the shaping of Australia down here. But there was a long imagining about Terra Australis, the Great Southland, whether it might be there, what it might be like. But of course, we're talking about the Pacific story and the Pacific story of the British world. And sometimes we get a bit of ashamed of our origins as convict origins, not a glorious start like the Americans. But in a way, I sometimes try to think, well, we were part of the scientific story of telling, of measuring something as big as the universe, or at least measuring the distance from the Earth to the Sun, because that's why Australia was founded by the British. Wallace had reached Tahiti in 1767, and then Cook was sent out in the late 1760s to measure the transit of Venus. And because they thought it might be a cloudy day in London on that particular day when Venus was tracking across the face of the Sun between the Earth and the Sun, they thought, we better have an insurance policy. Let's send someone out to this new place, Tahiti, and we'll take some observations there. So Cook came with a whole bunch of scientists and botanists, and he, after going to view the transit of Venus, he actually touched the Australian coast and trekked up the coast and finally took possession at Possession Island in 1770. Now, then Australia becomes part of a big story which is connected to the American Revolution. And, Australian relations with America go back a long way, because if it wasn't for the American Revolution, we mightn't have had a convict colony here, because the British used to sell their convicts to the Americas. Contractors would take boatloads of young men and women who had been convicted in British courts but were seen to be not beyond hope. They were sold off to contractors who took them to Maryland and other parts of the Northeast in America, and sold them into bondage for 5 or 10 years, and then they would get their freedom and become American settlers. And there was a roaring trade in this from about the 1720s up to the time of the American Revolution, and suddenly the American colony said, we don't want any of your trash anymore. And so there was a halt to that trade. The British had to cobble together all sorts of short-term solutions, including putting them on hulks in the Thames, old ships that couldn't sail anymore, but you could pack prisoners onto. And then they started to look for another place to put them, and they looked at Canada and Africa, and finally they thought, oh, what about New South Wales that Cook discovered? And so they decided to send the first fleet here in 1788. But some people have argued, including my colleague who lives next to me in the history program, Alan Frost, that in fact this search was only partly about a place to put convicts, and it was really about forging a second British Empire. Because when you think of it, the British had lost the American colonies, which was a great prize. And there was incredible humiliation. And so they wanted to recapture their what they saw as a dominance, and they chose to supplant the Spanish from the Pacific. So Alan Frost has argued, and others have supported that, including Geoffrey Blainey, who first came up with this idea, was that Australia was also a sea base, and the convicts were used as a labour force in this forging of a second British Empire. But what I'm interested today is to talk about, at the last part of my lecture, what sort of ideas people brought in their heads about land. What were the European meanings of land? Well, that little pyramid-shaped thing is probably a good idea to give you a sense of status and power in British society, because that little dot at the top represents the gentry who owned most of the land of England. That small dot, a couple of percent of people, 4 to 5%, had most of the land holdings and the wealth of England. The second band are the middle ranks, people with professions, perhaps businesses, etc., but usually didn't have much land. And the third band were the lower orders, what we might call the working class today, but best to use the term lower orders, because they looked to the very high ranks for protection and support. So it was a hierarchical society, Britain, and its ordering principle was the holding of land. And the key idea in that was primogeniture. Anyone have an idea what primogeniture might mean? That's correct. Unlike in some other societies where the land went to all the children, or perhaps all the male children, and was split up, in England there was a desire to maintain the integrity of the holding of land of the family, so it was only passed down to the oldest son. That was the rules of primogeniture. And the other sons had to be cared for in other ways. They might have got bought a living in the army, or bought a place in the church, so they become a clergyman with some status and whatever. But it was the firstborn that that ruled, and of course, the women were just found good marriage partners with dowries, etc. But they had no rights to land, so it was about the firstborn male. And so, land was the basis of political and economic power in England. The House of Lords and the House of Commons, the lower house, were both ruled by landowners and filled with landowners. Very few other people were even in the lower house. And here you can see one of the great estates of England, with the large manor house, the landscaped gardens, the tenant farms, the huge driveways. You know, these were dotted all over the countryside in England, and they were the seats of power. This was the real basis of power. Those men then would go to Parliament and sit in Parliament and make the laws of England. And everyone around them was beholden to them. All the shopkeepers in the area, all the workers would find their sustenance through the power of the big house. And it was all cemented by patronage, that if deference was given to the large landowner, the lord, the gentleman, then he would look after the tenant farmers, he'd look after the workers, etc. And so the big house was the whole focus of everything. And one of the biggest of houses is, of course, this place. It's Blenheim Palace in Oxfordshire, the home of the first John Churchill. Winston Churchill is related to that family, but he wasn't one of the firstborn sons, so he didn't get Blenheim Palace, although he got to be buried there because he was such a famous English person. But that great place was gained because Queen Anne gave John Churchill enough money and enough land to build that magnificent place, which you must visit if you go anywhere in the vicinity of Oxfordshire in England. And he won it in the wars against the Dutch, He had a series of great victories, one of them the Battle of Blenheim, which I think was about 1705 or something, and he was able to build that great castle and fill it with tapestries glorifying the particular campaigns he was involved in. And so this became, as the Duke of Marlborough, one of the great powerhouses of the British system of politics and landowning. And there he is there, shown in his military regalia. And it was this landed power which intensified over the centuries just before Australia was founded. And partly it was intensified by particular movements. One of them was the application of science to farming. There was a farming revolution before there was an industrial revolution. And there were various techniques that were used to improve the land, putting fodder crops in instead of leaving the land fallow to rest it, just putting a different crop in, soil improvement techniques, animal husbandry techniques, before Mendelssohn and the science of genetics, but people just on the ground knew good common sense about breeding. So animal stocks increased and the worth of animals. And of course, people then started to play with ploughs and other farming equipment. So that was one of the things that increased the power of land in England. The second one was the enclosure movement. And the enclosure movement was probably the most revolutionary movement in England landholding for 1,000 years. Because what the big landowners did was they looked around them and they saw not only an antiquated system of landholding where there were strips of land everywhere, because the land of the village, the good land was up there and the poor land was there and the bad land was there. In the old times, it was shared out. So everyone had a bit of the good, the bad and the best land. But that was, of course, very difficult to farm properly. You couldn't apply machinery to all these little strips. So part of the scientific movement in farming was to aggregate those properties and to get rid of the small strips and to put the land into the hand of more agri-farmers, if you like, agri-business farmers. But the other movement was that these people looked around the village and they saw a lot of common lands that everyone had access to. These were places where the peasants and the small agricultural labourers would run a cow so they would be able to pay their bills at the end of the year. They could gather wood off the commons. It was very important to their livelihood. But of course, it was seen to be unproductive land. So the large landowners got together, petitioned Parliament and said, we want to convert the commons to land for farms. And of course, once that was done by Parliament, they bought it because they had the money. There were actually thousands of these acts went through Parliament in the 18th century. So right across England, there was this revolution of land usage by all the common areas being pretty much gone. Not entirely gone, but most of them were gone. And this allowed the gaining of more land by the few and the emergence of high farming, whereby larger farms emerged. And by the end of the sort of 18th into the 19th century, 4/5 of the agricultural land of England was owned by about 7,000 people. An amazing land grab. So it changed the world. And a historian named Huggard talked about this transformation. I'll just read a little bit. He said, consider for a moment what enclosure might have meant to the peasants in the village. The initial hints about the petition to Parliament, the rumours and uncertainties among them about the passage of the little comprehended bill, followed by the descent of outside commissioners, surveyors, clerks and solicitors upon the village world. After the award had been made, there was frequently a storm of activity such as the village might never have before experienced. Squatters' huts on the commons were torn down for the last time. Trees were felled to make fences, hedges planted, ditches dug. New roads were built and other roads and bridges were repaired. Wealthier farmers had new houses built on their enclosed farms and let off their former farmhouses in the village to two or three labouring families. Within a decade or so, the physical appearance of many villages was totally transformed. Gone were the scattered strips in the huge open fields and the vast stretches of unfenced common, and with them a way of life which stretched back for century after century. So it was a revolution in the 18th century of the British countryside. And this led to a revolution in social relations. Because in the old paternal world, people, if they were workers, labourers, would turn up at a hiring fair. They might wear a particular thing in their hat to show that they were a thresher or a reaper or a shearer or something. And they'd walk around like this, and if a man thought they looked strapping, he'd say, "My fellow, would you like to come and work for me?" And they'd make an agreement. And that meant that that man would come and live in the farmer's house for 1 year under a payment for 1 year, and he was given board and lodging for 1 year, whether it rained or whatever. So it was a security. He was under the paternal protection of that landlord, but he was being cared for. Once high farming started, it was a capitalist business, and the farmers not only wanted to save money by shifting to day labour, not annual contracts, but they also didn't want to share their fine houses with a slovenly shearer or a whatever, and so they wanted to move them out of their world. And so people were hired on day labour contracts, which meant if it rained, there was no work, you didn't get paid. So it was an impact on the lower orders, and it changed the social relations into one more of capitalism rather than of a paternal caring. There was also changing relations in rights to land. It was seen to be exclusive, owned by people. And, of course, the rise of hunting led to draconian game laws that people said, this is my land, I own everything on it. I own the rabbits and the deer that go upon it. I own the wood and the water upon it. And so there was a whole series of acts and legislation put into place to protect the rights of property. There were gamekeepers whose job was to make sure that there was no one poaching things off the Lord's lands. And so the whole notion of land ownership became much more definite and precise and supported by a whole body of legislation against people who were trying to take the rights of property. There was, of course, responses to all this. William Cobbett was a journalist in the 1820s who was incensed by what was happening to the old rural world of England. He wrote a series of articles in one of the cheap new mass circulation newspapers. Of course, by the 1820s, the tax was off newspapers and they became cheap and more accessible. So ideas started to circulate amongst the lower orders, just at the time that the lords were banning them, putting them onto day labour, saying, "We don't owe you anything, you fend for yourself." And this was the emergence of class politics at this time. And part of that was the radicalism of Cobbett, who was against what was happening. And he used to ride around England and wrote about what he saw, and it was a passionate defence of the old rural world. And listen to what he says in one article. "The people, poor, dirty-looking, ragged, but particularly dirty. The men and boys with dirty faces and dirty smock frocks and dirty shirts, and good God, what a difference between the wife of a labouring man here and the wife of a labouring man in the forests and woodlands of Hampshire and Sussex. Invariably have I observed that the richer the soil and the more destitute of woods, that is to say, the more purely a corn country, the more miserable the labourers. The cause is this, the big bullfrog grasps all." He's talking about the big landowners, the big bullfrogs. "In this beautiful island, every inch of land is appropriated by the rich. No hedges, no ditches, no commons, no grassy lanes. A country divided into great farms. A few trees surround the great farmhouse. All the rest is bare of trees, and the wretched labourer has not a stick of wood and has no place for a pig or a cow to graze or even to lie down upon." So you can see that this time there was a great anger building in Britain and Ireland and in Scotland about land tenure issues. And it's demonstrated by the fact that the Chartists who were on about democratic reform, annual parliaments, payment of members, the right to vote for everyone, also talked about land reform, what they called home colonisation. Get some of the land off the rich, give it to the little people. And they were saying, you don't need to go overseas to get cheap land, let's reform things in England. But of course, most people saw the way out was to emigrate to new parts of the British Empire, North America, the American colonies, Canada, Australia, parts of South Africa, New Zealand. This was the safety valve of England. From the 1830s, people started to link emigration and land. So you can see that because of the events of the 18th century, English people at the bottom had a great desire to gain land, a great grievance about land being taken from them, a strong memory of enclosure through their family traditions and things. And this is, of course, part of the cultural baggage they bring. So when they come to new lands and they meet Indigenous people, this you can see where they're coming from. They've got a great desire for land, and that sets up the land as the flashpoint of relations between these two groups. So let's take a break there, and we'll be back in about 5 minutes or so, 10 minutes, and I'll talk about possessing Australia.